Mark got his PhD at Oxford and was a postdoc for a number of years at the Santa Fe Institute, where he received the, was it McDonald Foundation Award, very prestigious award, and is now a professor at the University of Michigan. And Mark has worked really quite broadly in statistical physics and complex systems, including problems in disordered systems like stained glass, phase transition, self-performance, criticality, biological evolution, and has now become recognized around the world for his important contributions to the theory and description of complex networks. Just last, and on a different line, something that you won't be talking about, presumably you have all seen this picture of the map of the U.S. in the last election, where the size of the states is not their actual geographical area, but is determined from an algorithm that takes into account the populations. This was, in fact, which you are all familiar with, made by Mark Newman together with his graduate student. With that, I'll just let Mark get on with it.
Thanks very much. Nice introduction. Thank you for the invitation. It's nice to be here. Yeah, that was sort of my greatest hit. A lot of fuss about that. We made these maps a couple of days after the election and put them on the internet. It's one of these snowballing things, and very soon we have a million hits on our website, hundreds of emails a day. Most of them complimentary, saying that it's, you know, a nice illustrative use of the technique. And some of them, mostly from the public, were not so complimentary. My first favorite was a borderline editor who wrote to me, accusing me of being a linguini-spined, panty-wearing liberal. okay, so that's my title for the day. I'm not going to talk about his said. We talk about networks. It's going to be a sort of introductory, colloquium-style, non-technical talk. I realize that since this is a Center for Theoretical Physics, I probably don't have to be as shy of mathematics as I do sometimes when I'm talking to audiences that contain, for example, a lot of experimentalists. So there isn't much math in this talk, but if you want to hear about, you know, the actual techniques that we use to solve these problems, then you can talk about that and feel free to ask during the talk or afterwards. So what's the deal? So there are many systems in the real world that can usefully be represented as networks. A network being, you know, a bunch of dots joined together by lines, also known as a graph, to mathematicians. It's a very simple abstraction of the structure of systems, and it throws away many of the features and many of the systems I'll be talking about, but nonetheless it's a very useful thing to do, because once you turn some system of interest into a network, we have a very big sort of toolbox of mathematical techniques that we can use to analyze it, say statistical things about the structure, make models of it, make predictions of what it can do, and so forth. And I'll talk about some of those things today. I want to start by giving you some examples of networks that people have looked at recently. So all this work I've been talking about is really driven by actual data, you know, experimental data on these systems that we're talking about. And many of the kinds of mathematical things we look at are inspired by looking at the real world, looking at a real network, and saying, oh, if it appears to have such and such property, let's make a model system that has that property. So we often start by looking at data, and I've done quite a lot of this myself. I think it's fun to get these big data sets and poke around with them and see if you can find interesting correlations and statistical properties. This here is a picture made by Kimberly Claffey from UCSD of the internet. So there are nodes here in this network, the dots, which you can't really see because they're very small, and there are lines connecting them for edges. And the nodes represent computers, or actually technically they represent groups of computers. They represent autonomous systems, like probably all the computers here at the IMO, or one autonomous system. So maybe one double here. And then the edges between them, if you're speaking of representing data connections. So this is the physical internet of computers connected together by multiple fiber. And you can see immediately by looking at it that, you know, this is obviously not just random, right? Yeah, it's kind of like it could be mess, but there's clearly some features there, like these big centers that have many connections coming out of them, and then a lot of this sort of filamentary stuff around the edge, a lot of nodes that only have one or two connections. My computer is probably
It's hard to see how this map is organized. There's no geographical.
There is no geography in this. Now, this has been organized solely with a view to putting the nodes in, arranging them in some way so that not too many of the edges cross over, so that you can just clearly see the network structure. But that essentially ignores geography. Of course, one could plot it on a map as well, but then lots of the edges would cross over if you're in that.
And are the big nodes recognizable?
Some of the big nodes are recognized. Yeah, there's some major switching centers on the internet. There's one, I think the two big ones here are the ones called Main East and Main West. New York and San Francisco. Those are really their names. Mays, M-A-E, is San Francisco. So that was an example of sort of technological network. Here's another technological network many of us are interested in. We have a flying airplane. That's a network in which the nodes are airports, and the edges connecting them are scattered. So you could see that you might be interested, for example, in what's the typical distance, or the shortest distance, between energy points. So you affect how many legs they generally need to make. This is another technological network, which is a picture of a power grid. So the nodes here are generating stations, substations, and the edges connecting them together are high voltage transmission lines. This one is sort of interesting because it has a hole in the middle. This is the Western States power grid of the United States. I don't know why it has a hole in the middle.
So there's not a single point of failure.
Sorry?
So there's not a single point of failure.
Okay. Maybe. It seems like you can have it sort of fail here somewhere, break off. I don't know.
Is that also geographically?
This is geographically, is it ignoring geography?
So does it have a meaning at all that there's a hole in the middle?
Well, see, that's a sort of interesting thing. So you get the geographic data and put it on a map, and you might not see this. But then you just take, extract the topology of the network and look at that in isolation, and you're here, and see this hole opens up. This is the sort of thing that you can discover by getting network data and just poking around and seeing for something interesting.
Where are the hubs here? And they're not as recognizable as in the other programs.
Sorry?
Where are the hubs here? Where are the nodes?
There really aren't any hubs in power grids. So by hubs, we mean, nodes that have very many connections, and some networks like the internet have these very distinct hubs, and I'll talk about this one later. Some of them don't. Some of them, all the nodes are obviously, and the power grid is an example of that. It doesn't have hubs. It's a very good approximation. And here is an example of something slightly different. This is an information network, so this is not a physical network now. This is a network of information. This is a portion of the World Wide Web. This is a picture of a website of a corporation. The dots, the nodes here, represent web pages, and the directed edges between them represent the hyperlinks. So when you click on one web page, it takes you to another web page. They're directed, that is, they have arrows on, because those links only go one way. You click on this page, it takes you to that page. There isn't necessarily anything you click on that page, it will take you back again. There might be, and in fact, some of these connections go both ways. There's one up there. But many of them do not. So this is what we call a directory hub. In common parlance, one often refers to the web and the internet and the web as the same thing. how we say, I found such and such a picture on the internet. But I want to distinguish here between the web, meaning the network of information connected together by the informational links, and the internet, which is a physical network of optical fiber on the internet. Here's another example of an information network, one that many of us are familiar with. This is a citation network. The nodes in this network are papers, in this case in graph theory, which is the mathematical study of networks. It's a sort of network about networks. And, oops, sorry, downstairs, I forgot to turn on. And the directed edges between them are when one paper cites another paper. Exactly. So this paper cites that paper, so it's a directed edge. This network has some things in common with the World Wide Web, and people have suggested that possibly there are some techniques developed for the World Wide Web that we could also apply to this one. For example, these Google-like eigenvector centrality measures that allow you to very accurately pin down the most relevant results for search could be applied to citation networks to maybe make better search engines for searching the scientific literature.
So, what's that? Well, I was going to ask what the color is in the
The colors are some sort of, and the things in the lines are some sort of representation of, well, colors, types of citations, and thickness, strengths of citations. So, meaning things like if a paper is cited many times in another paper rather than just mentioned once. So, you know, that might contain relevant information. If a paper cites another one many times, it's maybe telling you that their information content is more closely linked than if it only cites it once. So there is one important difference between this and the web, which is that this is an acyclic directed graph. So you can only cite the paper that has already been written. You can't cite a paper that will be written 10 years from now, right? So that means that all the edges in this graph have to point backwards in time to papers that were written previously. In this particular plot, backwards in time is up on the graph. Well, actually, the lines here are years, so it is possible to have a horizontal line. You know, a paper published late in the year can cite multiple. But there are no examples. And of course, that's only approximately true, but it's a pretty good approximation. What that means is that there are no closed loops in the network, because you can find paths that go up, but there's no way of finding a path that goes back down again to close the loop. So it has no closed loops in it, and that means, for example, that then tells you mathematical things about it. For example, the adjacency matrix of this network is nilpotent at all, its eigenvalue is zero. Once you know that, and you can work out a bunch of other things about these networks. And these are the kind of things you should notice that because of some physical or social reason, the network has a certain property, you convert that to some mathematical feature and then exploit that in the models to extract other things about this network. Amongst other things, it turns out that that property of having all eigenvalues zero means that the kind of eigenvector centrality measures that Google uses to rank websites would not work on this network. It would fail utterly. And there's been some interesting discussion of how you could generalize or extend the kind of things that search engines do to make a similar search engine for this, but it hasn't been done, implemented successfully yet, as far as I know. Here's another example of an information network. This sort of fun one put together by my friend Wallace Krebs. The nodes here represent books, and the connections between them are if lots of people bought the same books on Amazon. So two books connected together if many people co-purchased both books. And these particular books are books about politics, and the red ones are Republican books, and the blue ones are Democratic books. You can see my interests taking in particular directions. Right? So, you know, for example, we have the Lies of George W. Bush and the Faith of George W. Bush. And the interesting thing here is that it splits very clearly. There's lots of connections here, and there's lots of connections here, and there's not many connections here.
And then there are a few guys in the middle who are not either blue or red. I don't know what these are. What's the rise of the Vulcan?
Little box of the cave.
Okay, so then there's biological networks. There's been a lot of excitement about this recently. I'm sure you're aware biology is by far the majority of all civilian science. It gets something like 75% of all non-defense research spending in America anyway. So biology is big business. There are many examples of biological networks. This particular pretty picture was made by a couple of friends of mine at San Francisco State University, and it shows a food web. The nodes in this network are species in an ecosystem. The ages connecting together are who eats whom for dinner. Very roughly speaking, on this plot, it's ranged in trophic order. So you have autotrophs at the bottom, things that don't eat anybody, like grass. And then you have the things that eat the autotrophs, herbivores. And then you have the things that eat the herbivores, and so on, in the great circle of life. You'll notice at the top there, there's a node which has a little to itself. So you can have edges that connect a node to itself. That's allowed. That's cannibalism, obviously, which usually means it eats its young or eats its dead. This particular network is a real network derived by painstaking examination of many species in a lake in Wisconsin called Little Rock Lake, freshwater lake. And that one right at the top there, the cannibalistic species, is the smallmouth bass, which I gather is a fish familiar to fishermen. Here's another biological example. This is a metabolic network. The nodes are metabolites, so chemicals in metabolism. And the directed edges between them are when one metabolite turns into another one in a chemical reaction. I actually don't think this is the best way of representing a metabolic network. I haven't seen people do this, but I really think a metabolic network should be represented as a bipartite network, where you have two sets of nodes, one representing reactions and one representing metabolites. And then you could have arrows going into a reaction if these metabolites are substrates for that reaction, and arrows coming out if some other metabolites are products of that reaction. This representation here only has the nodes for the metabolites and no nodes for the reactions, and so I think it ends up throwing away quite a lot of information. But this is the way it's normally portrayed. You've probably seen those big charts, maybe the biochemists didn't have on their walls these huge great things with like all the known metabolic reactions on them and written really small. And this is just one portion of those. This is from paper by Stefan Sergey-Masloff. It's a picture of protein interaction networks. So the previous one was chemical interactions between metabolites. This is physical interactions between proteins. So proteins, one of their main modes of interaction is, you know, physical docking with one another. They're shaped in certain ways. They have some conformation that will have grooves and bits sticking out and so forth, and they actually sort of physically fit together somehow and mechanically interact with one another, do something in the cell. And this, there's been a lot of excitement about this recently. There's a variety of ways of getting these networks, but there's one particular technique called a yeast tube hybrid screen, which allows you to deduce many connections in this network in a relatively small number of experiments by a clever sort of combinatorial technique. And so in the last 3 years or so, there have been a lot of people working on this to try and deduce the structure of these networks of which proteins interact physically with which other ones. Okay, so no talk would be complete without a double cutting. So last type of network I wanted to mention is social networks, which is sort of my favorite, what I mostly work on, networks of people. And I like this cartoon because it sort of represents what a social network is. So here's Gilbert. He says, I've created a schematic of office politics in my house. And there it is, you can see it. As a social network. Let's say I wanted to ruin Ted's career. I could say bad things to Tina about Ted. Tina couples with Ming, in case you have a class with Carol. Carol is secretary for Ted's boss, so Ted would be history. I like this cartoon for two reasons. One, it illustrates an important feature of social networks, that there are many different definitions of the connection between people in a social network. And it's very important to be clear about what your definition is and use the right one if you want to answer specific questions. So in this case, we're talking about the propagation of a rumor over the network, so these kinds of connections are appropriate. But if we were talking about the propagation of a disease, for example, you know, the flu, then what you care about is who's been sitting in a confined space with whom recently. Totally different definition of a connection, so you need to choose the right one for the thing that you're thinking of. The other thing that this illustrates is why we're interested in social networks. One of the main reasons is because things spread, in this case like rumors, but also things like diseases, news, jokes, all sorts of things spread over social networks. Here's a few examples. This is a picture that I got from Jim Moody at Ohio State University. This is a picture of friendships amongst school children in a school in the United States, a high school. The dots are the children, and the edges are who's friends with whom. And you notice they have arrows on. This is their record network. That's because the friendships are determined by just asking people. Saying, so, who are you friends with? And they say, well, I'm friends with that person over there. So that's a directed link, but if you go ask that person over there, they might well say, oh, I've never seen that person in my life. And in fact, that turns out to happen an alarmingly large fraction of time, which is why many of these connections only go one way and not the other.
What are the different colors?
Okay, so excellent question. So the thing that immediately leaps out at you when you look at this picture is this divided into these four clumps of different colored nodes. So what's actually happening here is there's two different divisions of this score. So there's division between these two clumps and those two clumps, which is actually, this is high school and this is the joining middle school there. There are two schools in separate but adjacent buildings. So maybe it's not a big surprise that there are fewer friendships between schools than within schools. But there's also this division between these two on this side, the primary blue nodes, and these two there, the primary yellow ones. Any guess what that is? No, good guess, but these are high school kids. Boys and girls like each other, actually.
Race.
Yes, thank you, race. The blue dots are the black kids and the yellow dots are the white kids. This is... there are races other than black and white. The good green are kids who self-identify as
black. So they're anything that's neither black nor white.
It means primarily Asians and Hispanics.
They didn't make further subclasses.
They didn't make further subclasses. So this is a well-known effect that sociologists have been aware of for decades, of course. If I have time, I will talk more about this later on. This is data from Friendster. People know what Friendster is? It's this online social networking thing where you can create an account and then you can make links to the people that you claim are your friends. And so it allows people sort of collaboratively to construct the social network of all the people who belong to this social networking site. And this is a plot of some of the data from there. One of the things that immediately jumps out to you looking at this is that there are some hubs. There are some people who at least say they have very many friends. This turns out to be a recurring motif in many of the networks we look at. There are these hubs we asked about earlier. There often tend to be nodes in the networks that have very many connections. That's very much visible here, too. This is a network from a contact tracing study of the spread of tuberculosis in an urban community. Now, this picture was also made by Aldous Krebs. People are very interested in the spread of disease, obviously for substantial practical reasons. Tuberculosis is spread by aerosols, an airborne disease, so who's been in sort of close physical proximity to that constitutes a contact here. And what you can see in this network is, again, that there are some hubs. There are some people who have very many contacts. And you can imagine that those people would be a serious health risk if they got sick. They see many people, maybe 100 people or something. So if they got sick, they could potentially spread the disease to a lot of other people, and public health workers are very concerned about this.
Is there some rule for how the dots are distributed around? Like, for example, like some are radial, but others seem not to be radial, but out in one direction.
That's a good question. So most of the pictures that I've been showing you were made using a standard layout algorithm called the Kamada-Kawai algorithm, in which what I do is basically you put masses on the nodes with springs on the edges, and then you just let the thing open. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't actually go on. You do it on the computer, and it comes to rest somewhere, and then you draw a picture of what you get. This particular one was not made by me. This was made by Aldous Krebs. And he writes his own software, and I don't know how it works. So I'm not certain of the exact algorithm he used to make this. But it's probably something a bit like that.
But the positions of all the squares are algorithmically determined.
They're determined by some algorithm, yes. Not by a first. So there's some computer algorithm that plots these in some attempt to minimize the number of crosses and make it look beautiful. This is sort of fun, but also has a serious point to it. This is a network of people who work on networks. So each node here represents a scientist, and they're connected together if they've co-authored a paper. The papers on which I based this were taken from this physics archive, archive.org, which you're probably familiar with. There's me, my group. And you see various other groups here, which I colored in different colors. This is sort of fun, but there's also an important point to doing things like this. In many cases, we're testing out algorithms or models or stuff like that. We like to have example networks where we feel we know what's going on. So having, for example, a social network that you personally are a part of and are well acquainted with is a good way to test whether your algorithms and models are doing sensible things. That's one reason why I created this network, though another reason was just because people like it. People love talking about themselves. You know. This is another example of a similar sort of thing. This is a network of the characters in Victor Hugo's large and frankly rather dreary book, Les Miserables, where, you know, so each of the nodes represents one of the characters and they're connected together if they appear together in any scene in the book. This is another case where, if you know the book, you can see whether your analysis of the network is making sense and corresponding. So,
talking about colors.
The colors, well,
the volume?
I probably won't get to talk about this later on, so fine, I'll tell you. So, the colors are derived by feeding us through an algorithm that I developed with my student Michel Gerben, which attempts to divide it. It's essentially a graph partitioning algorithm. It tends to divide it into groups such that most of the edges lie within groups and only a few edges lie between groups. The way it does that is it uses a measure called betweenness, which measures how many geodesic paths on the network flow along each edge. And it looks for edges that have many paths between other vertices flowing along them, and you remove those from the network, and then look at the groups that get split up into. So the short answer is they're sort of the natural clusters that the network breaks down.
Sorry, what's the line game that defines the relationship between them?
The relationship is that they appear together in some scene in the book. This is another network of school children in a high school. In this network, the blue and the pink dots represent the kids again. They have the traditional baby gift color code. And there is an edge connecting two dots together if they dated during their high school career. I think, sorry?
This one is not directed.
The funny thing is, people seem to agree about that pretty often.
So what does it mean if they're adjacent but just online?
Oh, that's just coincidence. There's no connection if they're adjacent but there's not. Position is safe. Doesn't matter. Many of us, I'm sure, would have liked to see a picture like this of our high school.
We can make
actually, we would have liked
the names.
We would have liked to make that. So the serious side to this, of course, is that people are very concerned these days about the spread of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases, and actually NIH is putting a lot of money into studies like this at the moment. This came from a very big study called the Adolescent Health Study that they did on something like 90,000 school kids they interviewed for this study. And it takes a lot of effort and money to interview 90,000 school kids about who they slept with.
So if I notice one place, or actually two places, it's hard to tell, one place for sure where two blue dots are
in. Yeah, it does happen occasionally.
But the other ones, I mean, nearby dots don't mean anything, but some actually seem to be touching.
That's just the flopping program didn't do very well. Again, I used this algorithm image of the springs. These two are touching. There could be an edge between them, they could not be. It's hard to tell because the way's been blocked. I would say in that case there probably aren't, because kids in this age group don't often admit to same sex.
So there are very few closed loops in that graph, isn't there?
This particular one, yeah, has amazingly few closed loops. That's one of the things that was pointed out about it, that it seems to have really surprisingly very few closed loops. Of course, to begin with, we expect the closed loops to be primarily of even length, because they have an even number of blues and an even number of pinks around them. So we wouldn't expect to find many loops of length 3 or 5 for a start. But even amongst the even length groups, we find substantially less than we would expect on the basis of chance. And there's been some discussion about why that would be. For example, why do you not find this loop of length 4, two boys and two girls who dated two different ways? Is there some sort of social taboo against dating the former girlfriend of your current something, your current boyfriend or something, whatever? I didn't say that quite right, but you might think. Yes.
Something very common about this is that there's one big connected cluster and then there's lots of pairs and small clusters.
Right. So this is a universal property of most of these networks, that there's one big cluster and a lot of small ones. It can also be true that there's no big cluster, but networks in which there's no big cluster, we don't tend to look at those systems as networks at all. If they're not connected up, then it would not, in most cases, it would not be natural even to think of them as a network. So most of the things that people think of as networks have one big cluster and lots of little ones. You don't tend to get two big clusters. And the reason for that is that if you have two big clusters, you know, order n clusters, size of the system, then you have order n squared ways you could put an edge between them. And only one of those has to be realized in order for them to be joined together and become just a single big cluster. And so in the limit of large n, it's staggeringly unlikely that none of those edges would exist. So you don't expect to get just one big cluster in the large n. And there's various models that show that. Okay, two more quick examples. This is a famous network made by Valdez from newspaper data. He read newspaper articles about the 9/11 hijackers and compiled this network in which two of the hijackers or their known associates are connected together if they were mentioned as being connected in some way in one of these newspaper articles, like they shared an apartment or something like that. And see, there's some structure here, there's this link here, and various things going on. I don't know, but I think that it's reasonable to suppose that that things like this are probably being done by, you know, the FBI or whoever, by using considerably better data than what we have access to just by reading the New York Times. I think people do find this a useful way of visualizing relationships between people and what's going on. One more example, this is kind of fun. It's a piece of network art, a guy called Mark Lombardi, now dead, sadly, he died 4 years ago, who used to make these things which were part social networks and part art. So you can't really read it, but there are people here and they connect together in various different ways. It's usually representing people who are doing sort of borderline criminal things, shoving money around between each other in, frankly, rather dubious ways, usually often involving politicians and so forth. So it's sort of part political statement, part network. Okay, fine. So there's a bunch of examples of sort of things we looked at. Here are some properties of networks that might be interesting to you. First one is this whole 6 degrees of separation, small world thing, which you probably heard about, actually. So there was this famous experiment in the 1960s, I guess, by a guy called Stanley Milgram, who was then at Harvard University. And he was interested in how closely are people connected together through this network of contacts between people. So he did this experiment where he sent letters to a bunch of people randomly chosen from the phone book of Omaha, Nebraska. And each of the letters was addressed to the same one person who was a friend of his, who was a stockbroker who lived in Boston. And there were instructions that came with the letter. You've got to get this letter to the target person, the stockbroker, but you're not allowed to just send it directly to him. You can only give it to him if you know him on a first name basis. And if you don't, which we will assume they didn't because they were random farmers from Omaha, then you have to give it to somebody that you do know on a first name basis, who you perceive as being closer in some sense to the target person than you are. That could mean really closer, geographically closer, somebody else who lives in Massachusetts or something, but it could also mean closer in some social sense, like somebody else in the stockbroking industry. It doesn't matter, you're allowed to choose. Choose any way you like, pass the letter on, and then that person repeats the exercise to pass the letter on again, and you see how many steps it takes before it arrives at the intended target person. So the amazing thing is that people then just throw these letters in the trash. I think people must have been substantially less jaded about junk mail then in the 60s than they are now. I know if I received one of these things, I'd go to the college. A good number of them got passed on. About a quarter of them reached their intended target, which is actually a surprisingly high number considering that, you know, there's some probability of being discarded at every step. Mm-hmm. So to have even a quarter of them left at the end is quite impressive. And of those quarter, it turns out that on average they took 6 steps to get from the random starting place in Nebraska to this stockbroker spot. And this is the origin of this myth about the 6 degrees of separation, that any 2 people in the country are separated by only 6 handshakes, which the 6 degrees of separation is not Milgram's phrase, actually, it was the title of this play. Came out in 1919, was later made into a film, which you might have seen, starring Rizzo from Greece and one of the Men in Black. And it's also passed into popular culture. You know, there's the Kevin Bacon game, where movie actors are linked together by being in different movies together. And that's actually an interesting example, because that's a network that's actually completely documented. There's something called the Internet Movie Database, you may have seen, which lists the cast lists of every movie ever made, to a good approximation. And so you can tell who's been in a movie with whom. And people have actually created sort of internet engines where you can find the shortest path from any actor you like to Kevin Bacon. And you can show that it's always a small distance. It's like the average distance is 4 or something like that. So the small world thing really does work in that case. You can actually prove that it does by exhaustively looking at the whole network. Of course, it doesn't have to be distance to Kevin Bacon, it can be distance to Kevin Bacon. And then there are these various different variations on it. Oh yes, the 6 degrees of Rogers Hornsby. Who's been in a Major League Baseball team with whom? There was this one in the New York Times. I don't know what the definition of a link was. It doesn't really say, but there's some interesting characters on it. Here's Saddam Hussein, Rudy Giuliani, Paul Simon, Eeyore, Madonna. Okay, so that's one thing. Now, the interesting thing, so this has real practical consequences for the real world. Here's an example. So the point here is that it's a short distance through the network from anybody to anybody else. So this could make a difference, for example, to the spread of a disease. Make a lot of difference. Yeah. Somebody on the East Coast gets the first case of this year's flu. How long does it take to spread to the whole country? It's going to make a lot of difference if it's only 6 steps from that person to anybody else in the country, from whether it's 100 steps or 1,000,000 steps. So it could have substantial practical consequences. Now, I don't have any data for the spread of the flu, but I do have this data, came from UCSD, for the spread of a computer virus. So I just want to show this little animation that they made. This is an animation showing the spread of a computer virus, what's a word technically, called Code Red, on July 19th, 2001, This is showing 24 hours of data. You know, it starts off just infecting a few places around the world. And over the course of 24 hours, it spreads. So the size of the dots are sort of representing how many things are infected at a particular location. So you can sort of see it slowly spreading. Yeah, at some point it just sort of takes off and just completely dominates the whole world. And this is sort of typical of epidemics. They have this sort of logistic growth behavior where it's slow at first and it takes off exponentially and then it flattens out as the thing saturates. And the reason this is happening is because there's such a short distance from everybody to everybody else. It doesn't take very long to saturate, in other words, to reach the whole world. Interesting thing is, it's not always been that way. Here's a counterexample. This is a map of the spread of the Black Death in the 14th century. So you probably know the Black Death started somewhere up there, sort of in northern Asia, and it spread down through Asia and then along the Silk Road, and then it spread along the Mediterranean, the shipping lanes, and then from there it spread upwards in waves through Europe starting in 1346. And these lines here represent some contours of where it had got to, so June 1348, December 1348, so forth, as it moves upwards. And right there, we see that this cannot possibly be displaying the small world effect, its network, because it's moving in these waves. It's not just spreading everywhere in the world all at once. In fact, it's doing exactly the opposite. It's moving in some strictly geographical sense, and it's taking years to move across Europe. That's telling you that it's not just going, sort of growing exponentially in the waves. The thing here does, it's actually the number of cases is growing linearly, because it's moving in these waves. For a unit time, roughly the same amount of area is covered by this disease. So the number of cases is just growing linearly. It's nothing like this. So it appears to be a fairly strong hypothesis, just by looking qualitatively at these data, that the world did not show the small world effect in 1348. But it does now. And somewhere in between, there was some qualitative change between the structure of the network stand and the structure of the network stand. Something changed. I don't know what. My guess is it's probably in the late 18th century, during the Industrial Revolution, when long-distance communication became possible, along with long-distance travel. But I don't know that. Small world effect has a very simple explanation in many ways. Here's some nice graphics I stole from a magazine, which is basically intended to scare teenagers, but it illustrates the point. So it is alleged that, in two languages, it is alleged that last year this young lady and this young gentleman slept together, and the previous year before that, each of them slept with three other people. There. And then the year before that, each of those people slept with three other people. And the year before that, each of those people slept with three other people, and so forth. So things growing exponentially, right? So the number of people you can reach after, you know, how many steps it is, d steps, distance, is some number to the power of d. That means that if you want to know what value of d do I need before I've reached everybody in the world, well, that value of d is going to go logarithmically, like the number of people in the world. So the number of steps you need to go to reach everybody in the world goes logarithmically like the size of the world, which means that it's small, because logarithm is a slowly growing function. This is the basic argument for why small world effect applies, but the main problem with it is obviously wrong, because there's this other effect, which is called transitivity, which is that, so I could say, you know, maybe I've got 100 friends, and each of my friends has got 100 friends, so there are 10,000 people two steps away from me. And there are 100 times that, or a million people three steps away, 100 million four steps away, 10 billion five steps away. That's it. I'm done. I only have to go five steps, and I've got the whole population of the world, because there's only 6 billion people in the world. But it's not right, because it may be true that I have 100 friends, and each of my friends has 100 friends, but their 100 friends are not different from my 100 friends. Those are the same as my 100 friends. The people I know the same people that I know. In other words, the friends of my friends are also my friends. Another way of putting that in network terms is there are a lot of triangles in the network. And it turns out that that's true. Most networks have an awful lot of triangles in them, which kind of invalidates that argument on previous transparency. A way of measuring that is the so-called clustering coefficient, which basically says, what's the average probability that two of my friends know each other? And so that's a number lies between 0 and 1. Here it is measured for a bunch of different networks. This is the column you should be looking at. And you see the results are typically sort of on the order of tens of percent. 10%, 20%, up to 60%. So it's maybe like a 30, 40% chance that two of your friends are also friends of each other.
Well, why are physics collaborations so different than biology collaborations?
An excellent question, to which I don't know the answer, but various biologists have suggested possible explanations, one of which is that they have a rather generous tradition of collaboration in biology, that they tend to put people as co-authors on their papers who did things that in physics could not be considered enough to justify co-authorship. For example, someone who synthesized the reagents or something like that for some experimental procedure might be given co-authorship. And those people tend not to know the other co-authors and often not to collaborate with them again in the future. So that reduces this sort of incestuous triangle forming process. So these numbers here are high in the sense that if you had to guess just on basis of random chance what these numbers would be, they would be many orders of magnitude lower. That's what these numbers here suggest. So there's obviously something significant socially going on here, or if it's not a social network, then whatever kind of network you're looking at, there's many more triangles here than you expect by chance. Okay, so I mentioned the small world effect, I mentioned the transitivity thing briefly. Here's another important property of networks that affects a lot of things. This is a nice article that you might have seen in a New Yorker a little while back by Malcolm Gladwell, in which he suggested that the real reason for this 6 degrees of separation thing is that we all know the same person, and her name is Lois Weisberg, and she lives in Chicago. So I don't think that's an entirely plausible explanation. You know, we're two steps to anybody else because we all know her and she knows everybody else. But there is a grain of truth in it, because it turns out that in most of these networks there are people who know a small number of people who really know a lot of other people. Or if it's not a social network, you know, some other kind of network. But there are some nodes in the network that really have a lot of connections. Here's a picture that I showed earlier on, again. This is that picture of who contacted who in that study of tuberculosis. And there are these hubs in the network, nodes that have very many connections. So the number of connections that a node has is called the degree of node. There are some nodes in the network that have very high degree, and that turns out to be very important for some processes. So I mentioned that it would be bad from a public health point of view if that person in the middle of the hub got sick, because they could give the disease to many other people. So what you might think was, okay, degree matters because, well, so the mean degree will matter. What matters is the average degree. If that's high, the disease will spread. If it's low, it'll spread more slowly, or maybe it won't be spread at all. Interesting thing is that it turns out that's not right. Turns out, in fact, it is the mean square degree that matters. Why? Because, yes, that person, if they get sick, they can give the disease to lots of other people. But they're also more likely to get the disease because they have many contacts that they can catch it from. So that degree, let's call it K, comes in once for how likely they are to catch the disease, and once for how likely they are to pass it on. So K, it comes in twice. So K squared is the thing that matters. And this is something that comes up repeatedly in theories of networks, that it's the mean square degree that always comes up where you think it might be the mean degree. And so if you have these networks that have even a small fraction of these hubs in them, the nodes with very high degree, they can have a disproportionately large effect. A hub with 1,000 edges coming out of it doesn't just have 1,000 times the effect of one with one edge, it has 1,000,000 times the effect of its k squared. So you can have just a very small fraction of these hubs, and it can totally change the qualitative behavior of the network. I'll show you just quickly one example of that, which I think is sort of fun. So one typically talks about the degree distribution of a network. Call it P sub A equals, well, the fraction of nodes with degree K. In other words, if I choose a node at random, it's the probability that that node will have degree K. Now, the interesting thing is that if I choose an edge at random in my network and I follow it to one of its ends, the degree of that node there that I reach is not distributed according to P of K. Why not? Because there were many different edges I could have chosen, and if I follow any of those, I reach this node here. So I'm more likely to reach a node that has many edges attached to it than one that only has one if I choose an edge at random. In fact, it's just going to be proportional to the degree. So if I choose an edge at random, then the probability of the distribution of the degree of the node that I reach is going to go like k p of k and not like p of k. That's not properly normalized. I'd better divide it by the sum of k p of k to make a properly normalized distribution. Let's call that q of k. That's the degree distribution for the node that I reached by following a randomly chosen edge. Now, suppose here's me, and I ask about the mean degree of each of my friends. What's the mean number of friends that my friend has? Well, that's easy now. So my friend is someone at the end of an edge. So their degree is distributed according to this qk. And the average of qk is just k times qk summed over all k, where k can go from 0 to infinity. So taking this expression here, that's also equal to sum over k, k squared, pk, over sum over k, pk. Just substituting that into there. So that's the average number of friends my friend has. Well, that's an interesting expression because it involves, again, a mean squared degree. This thing on the top here, k squared times the distribution of k, is by definition just the mean squared degree. And this thing on the bottom is just the mean degree. So the average number of friends my friend has is just equal to the mean squared degree divided by the mean degree. Well, that's interesting. Let's calculate average number of friends my friend has minus average number of friends I have. Okay, so I'm just a randomly chosen person in the network. So the average number of friends I have is just whatever the average of k is. Well, let's take out a factor of 1 upon k from that. And I've got k squared minus average of k all squared. So that thing in there is just the variance of the degree distribution. And this here is just equal to sigma squared k over average of k. The variance divided by the average is the difference between the mean number of friends my friends have and the mean number of friends I have. But wait, this thing on top here is the square of a real number. It's positive. And that thing on the bottom is also positive. So that means that this is greater than or equal to zero. In other words, the mean number of friends my friend has is always greater than or equal to the number of friends that I have. And in actual fact, it's only equal in the case where everybody has the exact same number of friends. So in any other case, it's true to say that the average number of friends my friends have is greater than the average number of friends I have. So you may feel that your friends have more friends than you do. And if so, you're absolutely right. They do. And it's a mathematical fact. It sounds like it can't possibly be correct, right? How can everyone have fewer friends than the people they know? It can't possibly be right, can it? But it can, precisely because of this business about following edges. The person who's friends with 100 people counts in that calculation 100 times for the 100 people that they're a friend with.
It also means your enemies have more enemies than you.
I'll get back to you.
more people hate the people that hate you than you hate
them. What do you say? Well, so anyway, this, here's the thing that I was talking about. This average of K-squared comes up over and over again in these studies and networks. Here's an example of a practical upshot of that. This is data from the SARS epidemic in, this is the outbreak in Singapore in 2003. This shows actually how it spread from each patient to each other patient. So it started off with sort of patient number one over there. So the interesting thing about this is that there were these super spreaders in SARS. You probably heard about that. There were some people, most people passed the disease on to only one other person, or maybe no other people. There were a small number of people who were the hubs in the network, and they passed it on to lots and lots of scores of other people. And you can see a few of them here in this data. So it starts off with number one, who is one of these super spreaders, and he or she spread it to a large number of people there. But what you see is most of the people they spread it to didn't spread it to anyone else, except for this one person, person number six here, who turned out to be another super spreader. And they spread it to many people, one of whom, number 35, was also a super spreader, and so on. So it's like, at every juncture, it's almost dying out, because almost everybody passes it on to no one else. But there are just a small fraction of these hubs in the network that, that every time you encounter one of those, it sort of multiplies it by this huge fraction, and it suddenly spreads to a lot of new people. So it's like, it's dying out, it's dying out, it's dying out, and suddenly it gets a big boost, and it's dying out. So you can see that these super spreaders are playing a crucial role. Even though it's a very small fraction of them, the disease persists in the community solely because of them, and if they weren't there, it would die out very quickly.
It depends on how fast the disease kills, though.
That's true. Of course, this disease, the majority of people, they didn't kill. But it also depends, you know, on how fast people recover, if they recover. That's certainly true. So the what you'd want here is degree defined as how many people do you have contact with during the period for which you're infectious before you either recover or die. So that's another example of where the definition of what constitutes contact has to be made rather carefully.
Yeah, is there no case where a super spreader does not come directly from another one, but where there's an intermediary?
Actually, number 130 there.
Oh, yes.
Six, you have one person spread on to only one of those. So it happens occasionally, but it's all, you know, very common.
Was that due to a lack of infection control measures in the hospital? That sometimes, I mean, people just, you know, messed up and they didn't control the infection. Whereas in other cases, people were more careful. Is that going on?
You mean in that particular case there? Or just generally?
Well, does anyone understand what these super spreaders
are? Oh, I see. I think it's really property of the mode of transmission. So this is not completely aside, but one theory is, so there are two modes of transmission. One is respiratory transmission, the other is fecal matter. And one theory is that the super spreaders were spreading through fecal matter. So, it could be in a hospital, or it could be, you know, the sewage system gets backed up or something like that. There could be some extenuating circumstances which, in effect, create contacts that weren't there before.
So you're looking at historic things here. You use this technique to do modeling, and so you've got potentially a flu pandemic.
Right, absolutely. So, well, there's a lot of interest in that. So particularly in this area of epidemiology, and in many of these things, you can just do an experiment, but with diseases, you can't. Of course, you can't release a disease to see how fast it will spread. So epidemiology has become one of the few areas of biology where theoretical predictions are really absolutely crucial for understanding what is going on. And so one of the big advances in theoretical epidemiology recently has been that people are beginning to incorporate knowledge about structured social networks. So traditional mathematical epidemiology used so-called fully mixed models, differential equation models based on the assumption that within any population group, transmission between any individual and any other individual is equally likely. Doesn't depend who you are. Of course, in a real social network, that's not the case at all. People who don't have contact there's no way that the disease can be transmitted. So the structure of the social network obviously matters greatly, and in particular, if you have things like super spreaders, that's going to make a lot of difference, spread the disease. So this is something that I've worked on quite a bit. We've done field studies, actually working out what structure these networks is, and then we've put together mathematical models and computer models, taking those network data and using to make predictions about the spread of particular diseases. But certainly many other people have been doing that as well. There have been some really very large-scale studies, like there was a big study at Los Alamos where they did a simulation of the entire population of the city of Portland, Oregon. You know, each person is sort of represented a little dot moving around, and they go places, and they have a whole map built in there, and a whole public transport system in there, and all sorts of things. The stuff that I do is much more modest and mostly sort of analytical and aimed at understanding sort of the basic structure of what goes on when you turn this parameter up, do more people get infected or less, and why? Those kinds of things. So we're not attempting to make the sort of quantitatively accurate predictions that they were making. We're more attempting to sort of understand when you change the structure of the network in this way, what does it change about the outcomes and so on. So absolutely, yes, people are doing exactly that. One of the main reasons why funding agencies are interested in this. So I'm out of time. I should really stop here. I was present some data and so forth, but I mean, I think you've got the idea. Just to summarize, so there are a lot of these systems that can be represented as networks, and the structure of those networks has substantial repercussions for the way these systems behave. We have both good data on many of these networks, and now, increasingly, we have models that allow us to take those data and make predictions about what will happen. There's still much to be done. One of the main things we don't understand here is the behavior of dynamical processes taking place on networks. We've got a lot of understanding about the structure, but we'd like to know how does that structure affect disease spread or something on a network. So there's many gaps in our knowledge, but I think it's an exciting area in which a lot is being done and a lot of people work at the moment. I'm going to stop talking now, but you should feel free to answer questions, and thank you for your attention.
Questions?
There's no questions.
Yeah, I've got questions already.
Yeah. Well, I'll just start from here where you were about to go. So it seems, this is a remarkable slide because these are completely different systems, and yet they seem to be two things in common. One of them is that the shape of some of the curves is remarkably similar. Well, for example, you know, power grids and cloud waves and mathematics. And then there are questions like some have tails and some seem to fall at a certain power, and then all of a sudden at a much slower power.
Right.
Are there classes of networks by which you can distinguish by effectively redistribution?
Maybe. So first of all, actually, this power grid is different from the others because it has a linear horizontal axis, but it doesn't have a logarithmic horizontal axis. So straight line means a different thing in that case. But you are absolutely right that many of these appear